York. This is Democracy Now!
I joined Facebook because I think Facebook has the potential to bring out the best in us. But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testifies before the Senate, accusing the social media giant of prioritizing profit over the safety of its billions of users. We'll air highlights and get response. Then to California to look at this weekend's devastating oil spill and the renewed calls to ban offshore oil drilling. Finally, becoming abolitionists, police protests, and the pursuit of freedom. We'll speak with human rights attorney, activist, and author Derrica Purnell.
For a generation of new Black activists, right, our calls to dismantle or to abolish the prison industrial complex didn't come from ignorance or a dismissal or because we just had enough. That was not our entry into this work. It's quite the contrary. We spent more than a decade organizing within the confines of the criminal legal system.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen gave explosive testimony before a Senate subcommittee Tuesday denouncing the social media giant for prioritizing astronomical profits over the safety of billions of users. Haugen's testimony gave a rare glimpse into the secretive tech company, which she accused of harming children, sowing division by boosting hateful content and undermining democracy. Haugen urged lawmakers to enact strict oversight over Facebook before it's too late. This is Frances Haugen.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal. I am here today to tell you that's not true.
Frances Haugen's testimony comes after she leaked tens of thousands of pages of internal Facebook documents. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Senate's expected to vote on a procedural step that would bring a suspension of the debt ceiling to a floor vote, even as Republicans insist they won't support the move. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told President Biden earlier this week Democrats would have to pass the bill through reconciliation, even though Republicans could allow the measure to pass with a simple majority. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted Republicans what he called irresponsibility.
We can stop this Republican-manufactured debt ceiling crisis in its tracks, or Republicans can keep driving our country ever closer to the first default in American history.
On Tuesday, President Biden said Democrats could move to reform filibuster rules to bypass the Republican blockade on the debt limit, though conservative Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have previously voiced their opposition to filibuster changes. According to research by ProPublica, the national debt rose by $7.8 trillion to $28 trillion, due in large part to Republicans and then-President Trump's 2017 tax cuts for corporations and the ultra-rich. Constituents of Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema are stepping up pressure on the corporate Democrat as she continues to threaten passage of the sweeping reconciliation package that would expand the nation's social safety net and combat the climate emergency. On Monday, Corina Ruiz, head of the Arizona DREAM Act Coalition and a former volunteer on the Sinema campaign, approached the senator on her flight to D.C. to ask her to support immigration reform as part of the legislation.
I just need to know if you can commit to passing a budget reconciliation that would include immigration and citizenship for people to be protected, like me and many others. Can you commit to that, Senator?
Senator Sinema mostly ignored Ruiz, even as she went on to share about her father's recent death. After her flight landed, Sinema was confronted by other constituents at the airport about what she wanted to cut from the Democrats' Build Back Better Act.
Do you want to cut climate priorities? Is it elder care that you want to cut, or is it child care?
The state of Missouri executed Ernest Lee Johnson Tuesday after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a petition to delay the killing. And despite pleas from lawmakers, activists, and even the Vatican to spare Johnson, who had an intellectual disability, it was Missouri's first execution in over a year and the seventh in the U.S. this year. In international news, Taiwan's defense minister says tensions with China are at their worst in 40 years, flagging the risk of an accidental strike after China sent a record number of military planes into Taiwanese airspace over the past 4 days. Taiwan said China would be able to mount a full-scale invasion of Taiwan by 2025. President Biden said Tuesday he spoke to Chinese President Xi Jinping, and both leaders agreed to adhere to an ongoing agreement between Beijing and Washington amidst the mounting tensions. The Taiwan Relations Act directs the U.S. to recognize Beijing rather than Taipei as its diplomatic partner. The U.S. provides weapons to Taiwan but does not take a position on its sovereignty. Amnesty International says the Taliban killed at least 13 members of the Hazara ethnic group on August 30th, shortly after the group took control of Afghanistan. Among the dead were 11 former government forces and a 17-year-old girl. In other news from Afghanistan, the Wall Street Journal reports Kabul risks facing major blackouts over the winter because the new Taliban government has not paid its electricity suppliers. Afghanistan does not have a national power grid. Kabul relies on imported electricity from Central Asian countries. The UN Security Council is meeting today to discuss the crisis in Ethiopia and the recent expulsion of seven senior UN officials from Ethiopia amidst the mounting humanitarian crisis in the war-torn Tigray region. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said last week he rejected this expulsion. This is Jens Larka of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
It is critically important that the humanitarian operation continues, and it does. We have a very high number of people in very urgent need in Tigray. In fact, 5.2 million people up there are in urgent need of assistance.
According to a CNN report, Ethiopia also used its flagship commercial airline to transport weapons during the war in Tigray. Romania's parliament has ousted Prime Minister Florin Câțu in a vote of no confidence after less than 1 year in power. Câțu will remain as the caretaker prime minister, and it's likely the previous ruling coalition will eventually replace his government. Romania has had a rapid succession of short-lived leaders over the past decade. In France, union leaders led a nationwide strike Tuesday to protest low wages and planned reforms to pensions and unemployment benefits. Workers are hoping to put pressure on the government of Emmanuel Macron ahead of next year's presidential election. This is a pensioner demonstrating Tuesday in Paris.
Everyone's purchasing power is going down, that of pensioners, of workers, of those who are unemployed, of the disabled. It's disgusting. Billions of euros are there. We just saw that tax evasion accounts for billions and billions of euros around the world. That could be enough to pay salaries in the hospitals, in the schools, a decent public service. I'm here because of all that. I'm here for the future of humanity, too, because we can talk about the climate in a general way. But if we don't change the system, it's as useless as a fart underwater.
Back in the United States, some 1,400 workers across all of Kellogg's cereal plants went on strike Tuesday as union negotiations have stalled for more than a year. The strike includes plants in Omaha, Nebraska, Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Memphis, Tennessee. A union representative says Kellogg's is threatening to outsource jobs to Mexico if workers don't accept the company's proposals, which include loss of premium health care, holiday and vacation pay, and reduced retirement benefits. Workers are also demanding better wages. Here in New York, the head of the Sergeants Benevolent Association police union resigned Tuesday, hours after the FBI raided its Manhattan headquarters. The home of now former union president Ed Mullins was also searched, though it's unclear what the target of the federal investigation is. The family of Henrietta Lacks, the African-American patient whose cells were taken by Johns Hopkins University Hospital without her consent in 1951, is suing the pharmaceutical company Thermo Fisher Scientific and demanding reparations in the intellectual property of those cells. The lawsuit denounces a racist medical system and accuses the drug company of using what is known as the HeLa cell line without their consent while making billions of dollars in profit. 7 decades ago, it was discovered that Lacks cells could live forever, helping scientists produce remedies for several diseases, including the first polio vaccine. And the U.S. Postal Service has launched a pilot program to offer some banking services in 4 cities. Customers in Washington, D.C., Falls Church, Virginia, Baltimore, Maryland, and the Bronx in New York can now cash paychecks and other types of checks up to $500 for a fee that's much lower than private cashing companies. The service, if expanded, could provide a government-run, more accessible option to the 14 million U.S. residents who are underbanked or unbanked. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the devastating testimony of Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. She testified for over 3 hours Tuesday during a Senate hearing about how bombshell disclosures about the social media giant.
Frances Haugen. I used to work at Facebook. I joined Facebook because I think Facebook has the potential to bring out the best in us. But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. Congressional action is needed. They won't solve this crisis without your help. Yesterday, we saw Facebook get taken off the internet. I don't know why I went down, but I know that for more than 5 hours, Facebook wasn't used to deepen divides, destabilize democracies, and make young girls and women feel bad about their bodies. It also means that millions of small businesses weren't able to reach potential customers, and countless photos of new babies weren't joyously celebrated by family and friends around the world. I believe in the potential of Facebook. We can have social media we enjoy that connects us without tearing apart our democracy, putting our children in danger, and sowing ethnic violence around the world. We can do better. During my time at Facebook, first working as the lead product manager for civic misinformation and later on counter-espionage, I saw Facebook repeatedly encounter conflicts between its own profits and our safety. Facebook consistently resolved these conflicts in favor of its own profits. The result has been more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. In some cases, this dangerous online talk has led to actual violence that harms and even kills people. This is not simply a matter of certain social media users being angry or unstable, or about one side being radicalized against the other. It is about Facebook choosing to grow at all costs, becoming an almost trillion-dollar company by buying its profits with our safety.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen went on to urge lawmakers to take action against Facebook.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal. I am here today to tell you that's not true. These problems are solvable. A safer, free speech respecting, more enjoyable social media is possible.
But there is one thing that I hope everyone takes away from these disclosures. It is that Facebook can change, but is clearly not going to do so on its own. My fear is that without action, divisive and extremist behaviors we see today are only the beginning. What we saw in Myanmar and are now seeing in Ethiopia are only the opening chapters of a story so terrifying, no one wants to read the end of it.
At Tuesday's hearing, the Senate subcommittee chair, Democratic Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, compared Facebook to big tobacco.
And big tech now faces that big tobacco jaw-dropping moment of truth. It is documented proof that Facebook knows its products can be addictive and toxic to children. Our children are the ones who are victims. Teens today, looking at themselves in the mirror, feel doubt and insecurity. Mark Zuckerberg ought to be looking at himself in the mirror today. And yet, rather than taking responsibility and showing leadership, Mr. Zuckerberg is going sailing. His new modus operandi, no apologies, no admission, no action, nothing to see here. Mark Zuckerberg, you need to come before this committee. You need to explain to Frances Haugen, to us, to the world, and to the parents of America what you were doing and why you did it.
Hours after Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testified, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg responded in a message posted on Facebook, writing, quote, "At the heart of these accusations is this idea that we prioritize profit over safety and well-being. That's just not true." Zuckerberg went on to write, "The argument that we deliberately push content that makes people angry for profit is deeply illogical. We make money from ads, and advertisers consistently tell us they don't want their ads next to harmful or angry content," he said. To talk more about Facebook, we're joined by two guests. In San Francisco, Roger McNamee is back with us, early investor in Facebook, mentor to the CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, then went on to write the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And in Los Angeles, we're joined by Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of the media advocacy group Free Press and co-founder of Change the Terms, a coalition that works to disrupt hate online. She's also a member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board. For those of you who watched Democracy Now! Yesterday, these were our two guests leading up to the hearing, and we thought we'd have you back to see what you were most affected by, what were you most surprised by. Roger McNamee, let's begin with you today. You know Mark Zuckerberg well. You were his mentor, early investor in Facebook. Talk about how significant this testimony is, and can you explain one thing? What is this issue of the algorithm? How does it give the lie to what Zuckerberg said? We're not trying to increase hate and anger.
So the thing here is there are two basic problems that we're dealing with. One is the culture of American business, where CEOs are told to prioritize shareholder value at all costs. And it's a little bit like the excuse, "I'm just following orders," right? That it absolves essentially all manner of sins. And that's a big part of the problem at Facebook. Essentially, think about the business this way. Advertising is the core of their economy. They get that through attention. And Facebook created a global network where people shared things with their intimate friends. And what happened was Facebook was the first medium on Earth to get access to what I call the inner self, the characteristics of people they would normally only disclose to their most intimate partners, friends, family. And in marketing, that stuff is gold. And the thing is, it's not just valuable to traditional marketers. It's incredibly valuable to scammers and people who are doing things that would otherwise be illegal. And if you think about what Facebook did, by connecting the whole world, it brought the world of scams into the mainstream. So when Mark says something like, "Well, you know, our advertisers consistently tell us they don't want to be by, you know, hostile content," the problem with that is that some of their biggest, most important advertisers are the actual people who spread dangerous content. So if you think about Stop the Steal, that was an advertising campaign. If you think about anti-vax, those people are advertisers. And so The issue here for Facebook is they've created this network that is essentially an unpatrolled commercial place that preys on people's emotions, because the best way to get people's attention is to trigger fear or outrage. And so the algorithms don't sit there going, I'm looking for fear or outrage. What they do is they're looking for things that get you to react. And it's simply a fact of human nature, of human psychology, that fear and outrage are the most effective way to do that. And that's why Frances Haugen's testimony is so devastating, because she is an expert in algorithm design. She is completely credible on this issue. And the stuff that she shared was not stuff that was her opinion. It was research created by the best people at Facebook at the direction of Facebook's management. And so when Facebook comes out afterwards saying she only worked there for 2 years and she wasn't in any of the meetings, none of that is relevant. And it's sort of classic deflection by Facebook. And I would argue that Facebook's responses yesterday really built Frances Haugen's credibility. Because if you sat there after that hearing, just ask yourself, who did you find more credible?
Well, but Roger, I wanted to ask you, one of the interesting aspects of the hearing was that both Democrats and Republicans on the Senate committee were equally hostile and skeptical in terms of the role of Facebook. But excuse me for being somewhat skeptical about the potential for real action here, because, I mean, on the one hand, there would be the alternative of actually breaking up Facebook, breaking up this huge Goliath, or even deeper reforms that address what you raise, which is the issue of that Shoshana Zuboff has so brilliantly documented of the commodification of the self by the digital giant companies of our day, which Facebook is only one of them. So what direction do you see potentially going in Congress to address what's been revealed here?
So I think skepticism about Congress is still appropriate. But I will tell you, as somebody who works with Congress all the time, I took great joy in watching the hearing yesterday to see a Republican senator reach out to the chairman and suggest that the two of them co-sponsor a new piece of legislation to address one of the issues that came up. And then a second time, a Republican talking about the national security aspect that Ms. Haugen talked about. And the idea of people on live television coming together, that is not something we've seen from Congress in a long time. And I agree with you. There are a lot of reasons to be skeptical. But my perspective on this is, if I could get into that room with them, I'd say, listen, Facebook is the poster child for what's wrong today. But the real problem is that in the United States, we have abdicated too much power to corporations. We've essentially said we're not going to regulate them. We're not going to supervise what they're doing. And in the process, we've allowed power to accumulate in a highly concentrated way, which is bad for democracy. But worse than that, we've allowed business models, and as you just described, surveillance capitalism, this notion of using surveillance to gather every piece of data possible about a person, the construction of models that allow you to predict their behavior, and then recommendation engines that allow you to manipulate their behavior. That business model, which began with Google, spread to Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft, is now being adopted throughout the economy. You cannot do a transaction anywhere in the economy without people collecting data, which they then buy and sell in a third-party marketplace. And that is, in my opinion, and I think if you ask Shoshana Zuboff, she would agree with this, that is as immoral as child labor. And if I could sit these members of the Senate down, I'd say, listen, guys, you're mad at Facebook today, but the way to solve the problem for kids, the way to solve the problem for democracy, the way to solve all of these problems, and Jessica, I'm sure, is going to talk about the civil rights aspects of this because they are humongous. But the way to do that is to end surveillance capitalism, because if we can't protect the rights of individuals, if you will, our human autonomy, what do we have?
But I wanted to bring Jessica in to get her reaction to the hearing, but also just a few figures that I've dug up in terms of Facebook users. In the United States, about 200 million of Facebook users. In Latin America, 280 million. More people in Latin America are using Facebook than in the United States itself. Haugen mentioned in her testimony what would happen in Myanmar and Ethiopia, the ethnic cleansing situations there that were powered in some degree by Facebook. Ethiopia only has 6 million Facebook followers, 6% of their population. Myanmar, 40% of their population. So what did you find from the hearings, what Haugen mentioned about this whole issue of how Facebook deals with integrity across languages and nations?
Yeah, as someone who's worked quite a bit on this issue through the Ya Basta Facebook campaign, where we're calling out the disparities in how Facebook is enforcing its rules in English and Spanish, I was very interested in the revelation that 87% of Facebook's investment in what they call integrity, the integrity of their systems, is devoted to English, despite that only 9% of Facebook users are using and speaking English on the platform. Another thing that Haugen revealed is that Facebook seems to invest a lot more in users who make more money, even though the risks to users are not necessarily distributed based on income. And of course they're not, right? We know that in society and in our digital world in particular, that women, people of color, religious minorities, ethnic minorities are often disproportionately targeted with bigotry. And so it was very interesting to hear her reflect and share the internal information that reveals that Facebook has not adequately invested to keep people safe across languages. So it should come as no surprise then that they played a contributing role in the genocide in Myanmar, that they are responsible for the rise in authoritarianism in the Philippines and Brazil and India and Ethiopia, because they have not implemented the type of mechanisms, they have not invested in the human personnel that is required to conduct content moderation. And so when I take that coupled with Facebook's incredibly disappointing and disrespectful response, and I layer on top of that how time after time Facebook has refused to offer any transparency whatsoever pertaining to the most basic questions about how they moderate content across languages in non-English languages, I'm horrified. I'm disgusted. And there's a very racist element to the lack of investment across language. And I think that needs to be addressed right away. You know, going back to Roger's point about the need to tamp down on surveillance capitalism, I think that's exactly right. And another thing that I thought was really important that Haugen said is that we actually need to think through new regulatory frameworks. And I think the time is now for Congress to pass a data privacy and civil rights law that limits the collection of our personal data, that limits algorithmic discrimination, that provides greater transparency about what the companies are doing and what they know about the harms they're causing across the globe, and that really provides accountability to not just the American public, but people across the world. So I think Congress needs to act. I was also encouraged by the real legitimate questions that came from both sides of the aisle. This was much less of a circus than other hearings we've seen about these issues. It does seem like Congress is getting much more serious about this. I hope they act. I think your skepticism is totally valid. And I want to lift up here that the Federal Trade Commission has the authority to look into this more deeply right away. And that should be imperative. That should happen right away. And the Federal Trade Commission needs the budget and the investment to go ahead and start investigating this.
Jessica Gonzalez, right now. I wanted to go to Senator Amy Klobuchar questioning Frances Haugen about how Facebook's algorithms may exacerbate the vulnerabilities of young girls with anorexia.
I'm concerned that this algorithms that they have pushes outrageous content, promoting anorexia and the like. I know it's personal to you. Do you think that their algorithms push some of this content to young girls?
Facebook knows that the engagement-based ranking, the way that they pick the content in Instagram for young users, for all users, amplifies preferences. And they have done something called a proactive incident response, where they take things that they've heard, for example, like, can you be led by the algorithms to anorexia content? And they have literally recreated that experiment themselves and confirmed, yes, this happens to people. So mm-hmm. Facebook knows that they are leading young users to anorexia content.
Senator Klobuchar also questioned Frances Haugen about the role of Facebook in the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
We've seen the same kind of content in the political world. You brought up other countries and what's been happening there. On 60 Minutes, you said that Facebook implemented safeguards to reduce misinformation ahead of the 2020 election, but turned off those safeguards right after the election. And you know that the insurrection occurred January 6th. Do you think that Facebook turned off the safeguards because they were costing the company money, because it was reducing profits?
Facebook has been emphasizing a false choice. They've said the safeguards that were in place before the election implicated free speech. The choices that were happening on the platform were really about how reactive and twitchy was the platform, right? Like how viral was the platform. And Facebook changed those safety defaults in the run-up to the election because they knew they were dangerous. And because they wanted that growth back, they wanted the acceleration of the platform back after the election, they returned to their original defaults. And the fact that they had to break the glass on January 6th and turn them back on, I think that's deeply problematic.
So they've kept their algorithm secret about how this works, but fully will know since they tamped down before the election, Jessica Gonzalez, on the reshares. You're a specialist in hate online. What has to be done in this case?
I mean, listen, they not only need to turn these safety protocols back on, they need to update their policies, but they really need to invest in the human personnel necessary to moderate hate. Another thing that Haugen said yesterday is that even with the best AI systems, those systems are going to only catch 10 to 20% of hate speech. We need more humans across languages to protect people, to protect the integrity, and to tamp down on lies, bigotry, authoritarianism, and violence that's budding on Facebook. The other thing we've been asking them to do for years now is to ban white supremacists and conspiracy theorists. And Haugen underscored yesterday that the same people who are spreading hate are prone to spreading lies. Facebook knows who these people are. They've decided to leave them up. There's a pattern of abuse here that Facebook has overlooked. And what Haugen has shown us is that Facebook's had actual knowledge and has extensively covered up in a serial way, the global harms that it's causing. And it needs to correct course immediately.
And Jessica, I just wanted to ask you one. We only have a few more seconds, but if you could comment on the allegations by Facebook that it catches 90% of the hate speech.
Yeah, they've said this over and over again, yet Haugen and the documents that Facebook's own research inform indicate they're only catching 3 to 5%. So I actually looked. Mark Zuckerberg has told this number to me personally. He's said this time and time again before Congress. And I saw the SEC documents that Haugen filed yesterday at he's also shared this with shareholders. And so this really needs to be looked into. They're materially misleading the public and shareholders about the nature and the quality of their content moderation in regards to hate speech.
Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board, co-founder of Change the Terms, which works to disrupt hate online. Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, early investor in Facebook, mentor to Mark Zuckerberg. Coming up, we go to California to look at this weekend's devastating oil spill and the calls to ban offshore drilling. Stay with us. Working for the Knife by Mitski. And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to California to look at this weekend's devastating oil spill off the coast of Huntington Beach, about 30 miles south of Los Angeles. Authorities say as many as 144,000 gallons of oil have leaked from a pipeline connected to an offshore oil platform. The pipeline is owned by the Texas-based Amplify Energy, which didn't report the leak until 12 hours after the Coast Guard was first notified. Investigators are looking into whether a ship anchor punctured the pipeline. California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency as cleanup crews race to minimize the environmental damage. Beaches in the area are expected to be closed for months. We're joined right now by Miyoko Sakashta. She is the Oceans Program Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, joining us from Oakland, California. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Miyoko, you have been out there. If you look from Huntington Beach out to the sea, you see a number of oil wells. That one is even further out that has caused this absolute catastrophe. Explain what you understand happened and what you feel needs to happen now.
Yes, this oil spill is just heartbreaking. And, you know, if I were to paint a broad picture, I think there are three key takeaways that all point to ending offshore drilling off of California and everywhere. First, offshore drilling is just dirty and dangerous. There's no safe way to do it. Here we, you know, you look out at the ocean and you see just miles of coastline that are oiled. The stench of petroleum is pervasive. And as you said, there are 144,000 gallons of oil that have poured out into the water. And this is more oil than the worst case scenario discharge from that pipeline in the oil spill response plan. Secondly, you know, the second lesson is there's no way, it's impossible to clean up an oil spill. It's just devastating. There are dead fish and birds washing ashore. And oil is, it's really harmful for birds. They can't fly. It destroys their insulation. They die of hypothermia. It's poisoned fish and shellfish, and they've closed the fishing off the coast. And, you know, out at sea, whales and dolphins are swimming through it, and they're breathing in the toxic vapors from the oil. So the third key takeaway is really that California's offshore platforms are a ticking time bomb. So whether it was this accident or another one, they were just waiting to happen. These oil platforms are more than 40 years old, and they're old and decrepit, and it's time to shut them down. They've outlived their intended lifespan. If you look at the 1978 environmental documents for these platforms, they were supposed to be decommissioned after 35 years, yet they're still, you know, lingering on and need to be closed down. So, you know, broad picture, I think this all points to sounding the alarm for President Biden and Governor Newsom that they need to stop issuing new drilling permits, and they should require all of the platforms off of California to decommission.
And Miyoko, how big is this problem? And when you talk about the platforms, I'm thinking not just of California, but obviously the Gulf of Mexico, where there are so many abandoned former drilling spots that no one is thinking 100 years down the pike, 200 years down the pike. What is going to happen to these capped wells or these lines? So how extensive is the problem along California's coast?
The problem along California's coast is extensive. All of the platforms were built, you know, in the late 60s, 70s, 80s. They're old and decrepit. I actually, a few years ago, went on a fact-finding mission on a boat out to inspect the various platforms off of California. And so we took Zodiacs out and went around, you know, Platform Ellie, the one that the pipeline is leaking from. And there's a cluster of platforms there that we went around. And as you look at them, you can see visually that they're rusted and that they're aging. They've been battered by the sea and the waves and the weather. And so, you know, we went out there to with thermal imaging cameras to spot methane leaks. And we did notice a lot of the platforms were flaring. And that's only supposed to happen if there's an accident or some sort of upset at the rig. And, you know, all these platforms look like they should have been shut down long ago. And I think you point to that there is a much broader issue here, which is we have offshore drilling platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, in Cook Inlet, Alaska, that are all facing this. And government reports recently have stated that, you know, a lot of the old pipelines out there have been sort of inadequately regulated and not decommissioned properly. So there are a lot of risks out in our ocean, and they really point to the fact that we need to stop issuing new drilling permits and decommission a lot of the stuff that's out there to phase it out.
And are there any estimates of what the cleanup costs would be to remove the dangers from these platforms?
I'm not familiar with what the cleanup costs are. They will be expensive, but you know, the truth is that the damage to our environment that they pose is so great that at any cost, we really need to be looking towards our future and not risking another major catastrophe. You know, we had the BP oil spill in 2010, and I don't think we learned the lesson that should have been learned then. Hopefully, you know, this Huntington Beach oil spill is another wake-up call that we really need to phase these things out. You know, it's not only the oil that we can see that's a spill risk and is devastating the coast, but also every day all of these drilling platforms are contributing to the climate crisis. And, you know, they're taking us in the opposite direction. Both California and President Biden have climate goals that these are the opposite of. So what they really need to do is figure out a plan for just transition to phase out existing drilling and, you know, decommission all these ticking time bombs.
Miyoko Sakashita, we want to thank you for being with us, Oceans Program Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Next up, Becoming Abolitionists, Police, Protests, and the Pursuit of Freedom. We'll speak to author Derica Purnell. Stay with us. Reprise by Jada G. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to the evolving discussion about abolishing police in the prison industrial complex amidst the disproportionate rates of police killings and incarceration of Black people. A new study published Thursday in the medical journal The Lancet estimates the federal database, known as the National Vital Statistics System, failed to count more than half the deaths from police violence over nearly 40 years. Researchers from the University of Washington also found Black people were killed by police at a rate 3.5 times higher than white people. This comes after a series of police killings of African Americans last year prompted a racial reckoning, including George Floyd in Minneapolis, Breonna Taylor in Louisville. Many states have since passed laws aimed at reforming police, but efforts to pass a federal law to overhaul policing failed to pass the Senate, and bipartisan talks over police reform broke down last month. For more, we're joined by Derecka Purnell, human rights lawyer, columnist for The Guardian, author of the new book, published Tuesday, Becoming Abolitionists, Police Protests and the Pursuit of Freedom. Derecka, welcome back to Democracy Now! You are
Hi. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on this book. You're a Black woman, a Black mother of two Black sons. You were an advocate for police reform, but you are now what you would call a police or prison abolitionist. Explain your journey.
Of course. So, like lots of people who grew up in the United States, I had just unexamined commitments to using and relying on police in my neighborhoods, in my community, because they were the institution that was the most well-resourced, right? So I had a ton of ranges of experience with police. And even throughout those horrible encounters, they were often the only option to respond to harm and to respond to violence. And so the book details that sort of early experiences and then what happened once I became part of social movements who pushed me to think more critically and more beautifully and more creatively about building a world without violence, right? With how to reduce our reliance on police and to reduce the reasons why people need them. The book also kind of describes a political journey of a generation, which I believe I'm a part of, who went from fighting for George Zimmerman's arrest and imprisonment in the wake of killing and murdering, rather, Trayvon Martin back in 2012, to become a generation who is leading, I would say, the call to abolish the entire carceral state. And so it documents that political journey of a generation, as well as my personal political journey of becoming an abolitionist.
And Derecka, you talk in your book about how your experiences in South Africa contributed to your becoming an abolitionist. Could you explain how and why?
Yes, of course. So in 2016, the student movement that was called or still is called Fees Must Fall and Roads Must Fall, they were pushing and fighting for a 0% increase in their tuition. And just to see the amount of repression that they received from the South African government, from the South African university presidents, I mean, sending in Black armed private police to attack them, brutalizing them because they were demanding free education, an end to colonization of the university and the entire country, really. To see them fight for the end of contractual labor so that their parents and janitorial workers and dining service workers could get benefits from the university. To watch them be met with so much repression from Black police, it was honestly just, it clicked like, oh yeah, diversity is not a salvific force. It's not enough to hire more Black cops, more women cops, more queer cops. That's ultimately not the problem with policing. Police are sent in to ultimately manage inequality and to stop people who are fighting for progressive change.
And how do you respond to those political leaders, white as well as African-American, who say that the abolitionist movement is not realistic, that the majority of people in the Black and brown community still want policing to protect them?
Well, I will say that I have lots of things to say to those people, especially the Black ones who are dismissive of abolition as an outside agitator call to action, which is completely not true. The tradition of people fighting for police and prison abolition, it's rooted in Black feminists like Miriam Cobham, Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Rachel Herzing. So I would just, one, just try to clarify what we mean when we say abolition. The second thing that I would say is that, well, they're very excited to point to those statistics about Black people who would like to continue to use police in their neighborhoods. But when we look at Black people who are also demanding, you know, more resources for education, more jobs in the community, universal health care, those political leaders are usually not interested in using statistical support for Black communities for those progressive causes. And so what happens is that There's a devaluing and a divestment and all the other resources that Black and brown people, working class people demand in their neighborhoods. And then they hurl, they hold up one specific statistic that they're willing to pay for in order to call it public safety. When actually, I imagine if we ask Black people and brown people, people all over the country, well, would you rather have more police or universal daycare? Would you rather have more police or education that's properly funded and culturally important? When you start asking more nuanced questions, the answers shift in our communities. And I think that we should ask more nuanced questions.
Derricka, you are a rape survivor. And people often bring up this type of violence when discussing the need for police and public safety. If you could talk about your argument that police are not the way to repair this harm and get justice in the aftermath of a sexual assault and sexual violence.
Yes, of course. So not only are they not the solution, police contribute to sexual violence. After police brutality, sexual misconduct is the second most reported complaint against cops. And then the people that they arrest, regardless of what the reason of arrest, they put them in jails and in prisons, and they make them vulnerable to sexual violence by people who work in jails and prisons. And so police perpetuate sexual violence. They're a site of sexual violence. And then in the few cases where they actually do go and may arrest someone, you have usually women who are fighting to get their rape kits tested. And thousands, 20, 30 thousands of rape kits are just sitting untested all across the United States. Now, what's so unfortunate is that police, in addition to them not being the solution, it's so frustrating because the people who are most vulnerable to sexual violence are vulnerable to people who they live and share their homes with. They're vulnerable to sexual violence for their neighbors, the people who they employ by, people who work in faith institutions. And so police are a part, they're a manifestation of that culture that's sexually violent. And if we want to reduce our reliance on policing, we also have to reduce the amount of rape culture that's so prevalent in the United States.
And could you comment on what's been happening in Congress and in terms of legislation around police abuse and police reform? Clearly, there was a lot of expectation last year and into the beginning of this year that there will be substantive change, but so much of it has fizzled out in terms of the refusal of Congress to be able to reach some kind of a real new legislation. What do you think needs to be done by those who are advocating abolition or systemic reform?
Well, the first thing that I would want to say is just my deepest sympathies to the family of George Floyd, who was given so many promises by Joe Biden, by other congressional leaders, that they would achieve police reform in the name of the person that they love. And it's honestly heartbreaking to watch politicians use families of victims of police violence to champion legislation that wouldn't have even saved the lives of the person that they lost. So I'm always just so sad that families are using this way to push an ineffective political agenda. Right. So the George Floyd Act was touted by President Biden and other congressional leaders as an attempt to, you know, eradicate bias and police and policing. But the issue is that George Floyd was initially stopped by Derek Chauvin over an alleged use of a counterfeit $20 bill. Congress had the opportunity to give people more resources during an unprecedented pandemic where unemployment rates were through the roof. We were facing a massive eviction crisis. Food insecurity was at its peak, right? So instead of giving people resources, giving us more stipends, making sure that we were protected if we lost our jobs, lost our homes, lost our health care, instead they chose to invest in police. And when someone called the cops on George Floyd, he was met with the level of brutality that police regularly and routinely employ in poor Black communities. And the idea that you could just use a pass one act to train police to better encounter people who may be breaking the law to survive is just woefully insufficient. So abolition are interested in reducing the reasons why people need police in addition to reducing the carceral state, which means at the national level, fighting for sweeping legislation that makes sure that people have not just food security or housing security, but quality investments in those institutions as well. It's why we fight for student debt cancellation. It's why we fight for universal health care. It's why we fight for universal child care and daycare, so that people who are in vulnerable situations, they can go to work, they can go to school, they can choose to have work that gives them dignity and excitement, right? Like, that's the kind of work that we're fighting for, and I believe that is well within our reach.
I want to go to Chapter 8 of your book. It's about the climate. It's titled, We Only Want the Earth. On the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina in August, Hurricane Ida left thousands without power, many stranded in Louisiana in its aftermath. I want to turn to a clip of the New Orleans police chief, Sean Ferguson, at a news conference for emergency preparations.
We are prepared to assist whatever recovery efforts we will have to assist with after this, but also anti-looting. We will not permit, we will not allow any looting throughout this process, and we will be out there to enforce that. So as I'm asking and begging and pleading with you, please hunker down now, as we will have to hunker down at some point in time ourselves.
So that's the New Orleans police chief. If you can respond to what he said, talk about the issue of the climate and how it relates to abolition, and also what we've seen along the border, you know, the whipping of Haitians in Del Rio, Texas.
Of course. Well, as our climate continues to heat because of global capitalism, one thing that's going to happen is that there's going to be a continuing of mass displacement of Black, brown people from all over the world. And once that displacement happens, the police are going to be the number one response to punish them, to whip them even, to incarcerate them. And so abolition and climate change are indispensable conversations that we have to have alongside each other. I learned from Critical Resistance that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when the city was just absolutely devastated by a hurricane, the very first thing that was built was a jail, and it was a jail that was used to arrest people. When we think about the jails that are in Puerto Rico, where are they positioned, right? They're positioned at the periphery of that island. So when there are hurricanes that happen, they're immediately flooded. You have people who are incarcerated who suffer a massive flooding, you know, are vulnerable to drowning, disease, vermin. If you look at any of the historical shifts and patterns of people who are migrating and immigrating to the U.S., who are fleeing climate catastrophe, they're met with Border Patrol and ICE. And so the police are going to be the default response to mitigate the impacts of climate change and environmental racism.
I wanted to ask you about the aftermath of the Michael Brown killing back in 2014, arguably a key flashpoint in the development of the Black Lives Matter movement. 7 years later, what do you make of whatever reforms or changes occurred in Ferguson and with the Ferguson Police Department?
Well, there's an organization right now who's still fighting to put pressure on the Ferguson Police Department to implement many of the very weak reforms that came as a result of the consent decree that was put into place under the Obama administration. So 7 years, you have people in Ferguson who are still fighting to eliminate, you know, cases of people who have outstanding warrants from nearly a decade ago. You have a few Black elected officials in Ferguson now, which I think could be a step forward because many of them are trying to figure out how to reduce the level of violence. But police are still there to serve the purpose of policing. They're still enforcing the evictions. They're still ticketing people who live in that community. They're doing it maybe more nicely, maybe more brown people are doing it, but essentially the day-to-day functions of the Ferguson Police Department is the same. And so it's not that we just have to fight the unconstitutional policing that's taking place in the country. As we see in Ferguson, much of that policing is completely constitutional. And I just am grateful that long after the cameras have left, that there are people in that neighborhood, people in those neighborhoods who are fighting to continue to limit the power that the Ferguson Police Department has.
We're all speaking here in New York. It's clear the next mayor will be Eric Adams, a former police officer, who really has rejected the idea of prison police abolition. Very simply, in the last seconds we have, your response, Derica.
Oh, of course he does. Black political officials, black people who are running for office, they get to do this. They get to say, I'm black and I'm a part of law enforcement. I understand both sides. And unfortunately, they just create more legitimacy for the police to do very bad things to harmful people. So I would just ask people to not be fooled by black people who say they understand both sides, because there is no both sides. There is a system of oppression where people have the power to kill, to incarcerate, and to arrest. And there are people who are vulnerable to it. And the people have to resist that.
We have to leave it there. Yes, okay, but I want to thank you so much, Derica Purnell, author of the new book, Becoming Abolitionists.